Well, thank you. Thank you for that great introduction. I appreciate the support for Fermilab, and we know that there's a lot of enthusiasm from the community surrounding the lab and elsewhere for high-energy physics and particle physics in the United States, and we are facing a really difficult time. So we would really appreciate it if you could contact your congressmen or senators and encourage them to support Fermilab and high-energy physics. But tonight we're going to talk about a few mysteries we have facing us in the universe. In particular, we'll just start by taking a look around, okay? You see a lot of different types of matter in the room, in our experience, in our world. I see this piece of wood, I see these walls, I see this glass. I can feel the air in the room. There's the atoms that make up my body, the molecules all around us. All of that stuff, all of the stuff you've ever experienced essentially comes down to this periodic table of the elements that we all learned about in school, right? So that stuff, in turn, breaks down into the subparts of atoms, basically electrons, protons, and neutrons, right? That makes up an awful lot of different kinds of things, a huge variety of substances. And then I would say the other thing we experience is light. So we see atoms in light, protons, neutrons, electrons in light. Well, amazingly enough, the last few decades of cosmology research has revealed that that in total makes up about 4 or 5% of the whole universe in terms of its mass and energy. The other 95% or so are not very well understood but very prevalent substances that fill our the space of the volume of our universe called dark matter and dark energy. And I'm going to try to, in the next hour or so, give you an impression about what these are, what these sorts of things are like, what we know about them, and how we hope to go about learning more about them through different kinds of experimentation. So, like Marianne was saying, I gave a slightly more formal talk on this at Fermilab back in November, where I had a PowerPoint presentation, and you know, I basically spoke for an hour and people listened, and then there were a few questions. I want to do it really different than that tonight. So I want to encourage you to, when something I say, you know, strikes you as curious, or you don't understand something, or want to know something I'm not saying, put your hand up or just ask a question, whatever. And let's kind of let you guide the conversation just as much as I do, okay? So let's start with dark matter. So if you can't see something, if it's dark, it's more or less invisible, or maybe completely invisible, how do we know it's there? Right? That's the first question most people ask me when we talk about these sorts of things. Well, you notice it's there from its influence of gravity. So imagine for a second that you notice you're always being pulled towards some place in space, okay, some point in space. You didn't see anything there, but you kept falling in towards it, right? Well, you can imagine inferring from that pull that there must be something heavy there, just like when we get pulled towards the Earth. Yeah. This is essentially how we know dark matter exists. So in the solar system, we have our sun and we have a planet, ours or Mars or anything else. And it stays in a stable orbit around that planet through the impact of two different forces. Okay, there's gravity that pulls the two bodies together, so the Earth or whatever gets pulled towards the sun by its gravitational pull. And also, just like a child on a merry-go-round, the centrifugal force pulls the planet away as it spins around the sun. Okay. So you've all been on merry-go-rounds, and when it gets spinning fast, you get pulled to the outside. Well, same idea with the planet. And those two forces balance each other. And because they balance, it goes around in a stable orbit. Well, one way you can use this is that if you look at how fast a planet is moving around an object like that, it provides an opportunity to measure or weigh the mass of that planet, of the star in the middle. Similarly, you can do this with moons and planets. So we have a pretty good measurement of Mars's a mass. Have you ever thought about how we go about figuring out how heavy a planet is? I mean, it's not something you could put in your bathroom scale, right? We know how heavy Mars is because we look at its moons going around it and study their speeds around the planet and use that to infer the mass of Mars. So in the same way, we can look at our whole galaxy, the Milky Way. So the Milky Way is a collection of about 100 billion stars, a lot like our star, but they vary a little bit, but more or less 100 billion or so stars similar to our own. And they travel in roughly circular orbits around the center of the galaxy, where there are lots of stars and lots of gas. And as you get farther out, there are fewer and fewer of these things. So if you go to the very outskirts of the galaxy and look at a star traveling around the Milky Way, if you measure how fast it's moving, you should be able to tell how heavy the galaxy it's orbiting around is. And astronomers have gone about doing this, not just in the Milky Way, but in lots and lots of galaxies. Many, many galaxies have been studied in this way. And what they find is astonishing. They find that there simply isn't enough matter in the form of stars and planets and gas and dust to account for those orbits. The galaxies are much, much heavier than they seem to be from their visible, ordinary matter counterparts. So there's something missing. At first it was called missing matter. Now we call it dark matter. Okay, are you with me so far? Good. All right. Good. Lots of nodding. I like that. Okay. So what could this stuff be? I should tell you right now that we still don't know the answer to that. We have pretty good guesses, and we've narrowed it down, but we don't know yet. So, yeah.
So isn't there a black hole in the center of the galaxy that could account for a lot of the mass?
So there is, in fact, a black hole in the middle of our galaxy and lots of others. In the case of the Milky Way, this black hole is more than 2 million times heavier than our sun. So it's a whopper, okay? It's an enormous black hole. But that's a tiny, tiny fraction overall of the dark matter. So it technically would be dark matter, though, because it doesn't give off light. But it's a very, very small part of it. So any other ideas of what dark matter in our galaxy might be? So he had a good hypothesis. Give me some others. Okay, yeah. So I'll talk a little bit more about antimatter later, but it turns out antimatter doesn't make a good candidate for dark matter. We would see it too easily. It's not dark is the problem. It's matter, but not dark.
Other dimensions. Other dimensions.
I'll talk about that one for sure later. But yeah, particles traveling other dimensions are one hypothesis for what dark matter might be.
Cosmic rays.
Okay, if they're the right kind of cosmic rays. Cosmic rays, we just mean particles zipping through space. If they're the right kind, namely the dark kind, they could, in fact, make up some of the dark matter. Okay. So, roughly speaking, the types of dark matter hypotheses people have come up with break down into two kinds of categories, classifications. We have clever names for these. Physicists make kind of embarrassingly clever names for things sometimes. We call one category machos, M-A-C-H-O-S, and the other one wimps, W-I-M-P-S. MACHO stands for Massive Compact Halo Object. That essentially means some piece of, you know, relatively normal matter, but just happens to be kind of dark. Things like planets, which are really hard to see in telescopes if they're far away, these would be MACHOs. Black holes. I know it doesn't sound like black holes are normal, sort of ordinary matter, but to a physicist, they kind of are. And that would be another kind of MACHO. And there are other things in between. WIMPs, on the other hand, stand for Weakly Interacting Massive Particles. These are very elusive, non-interacting or weakly interacting particles that would exist in clouds of these clouds of particles, kind of like a gas of non-interacting particles that fill the whole galaxy. So these are kind of the two paradigms for what dark matter might be made up of. Let's start talking about MACHOs, though. So back in the 1970s, when astronomers studied enough galaxies and really became convinced, okay, there's a lot of missing matter here, a lot of dark matter, they really gravitated, excuse the pun, towards the MACHO hypothesis. The reason is because the part of the universe they're familiar with, stars and planets and et cetera, well, those are very similar to MACHOs. So if most of the world you know about is of one variety, you might start with that guess to say the part you don't know about is similar. It's a reasonable place to start. Turned out it was wrong. But they considered a long list of possible MACHOs. So to understand where all these MACHO candidates come from, let's talk about how stars change and evolve with time. So before you have a star, what you have in billions of years ago, say, our own star before it was a star, was just a cloud of gas. It was basically a big cloud of hydrogen and helium before many of the stars formed. Gravity pulls that cloud together, and in some instances, enough gas gets collected in one place at one time just to form a star. If there isn't that much gas there, it's not dense enough, it might not quite form a star. It could form instead something smaller that doesn't burn by nuclear fusion. It could just be something like a giant planet. So if you have something like a Jupiter-like planet and you had enough of them out there, these could be machos, these could be the dark matter. Even better, you could have even bigger objects than Jupiter, but not quite as big as a star called a brown dwarfs. These are almost burning stars, but not quite. We call them brown dwarf stars. So, okay, now let's go to stars. So you collapsed enough gas together and form a star like ours in our solar system. Eventually, that star is going to run out of nuclear fuel to burn. So the reason the sun shines is because it's converting light elements like helium into heavier elements and so on. Well, eventually, it will run out of that fuel, and it won't be able to burn it easily, and it will grow. And when it does, our star will become something called a red giant star. It will become so big in size that Mercury and Venus are going to be swallowed up. It will become bigger than the orbits of those two planets. And even that won't last forever. When it's done, it will burn all of that fuel, and it will collapse down to something called a white dwarf. So a white dwarf star weighs almost as much as the sun does, but it takes up the size of about the Earth. So it's a very, very dense object. It's not burning fuel anymore. It's run out of fuel, but it's still white because it's essentially glowing from its earlier heat. It's like white hot coals. Okay, you're not burning the wood you had to begin with, but even when you're done burning the wood, it still kind of glows. It's that sort of idea. So in the end, you have a white dwarf. White dwarfs are so faint that they could, again, make up the dark matter. So now we have our macho list consisting of like planets, brown dwarfs, and white dwarfs. There's another trajectory that stars can take. If they're not like our sun, but are even heavier, then eventually they're going to explode. They're ticking time bombs. These sorts of stars get very big, they burn up all their fuel, and then they collapse. And when they do, they rebound and create something known as a supernova explosion. So if there's a supernova that occurs anywhere in our galaxy, it will suddenly become bright as day. It will become the brightest thing in the sky, with the exception of maybe the sun. It will, you know, be brighter than the moon or brighter than any planet or star in the sky. And it will stay that way for a month or so. So the people have seen these occur in our galaxy on a few occasions. I think the most recent of which was in the 1600s. But when a supernova is finished, what it leaves behind is one of two things, depending on how heavy it is. If it's very, very heavy, it will leave behind a black hole. And if it's not quite that heavy, it will leave behind something called a neutron star. So we know that ordinary atoms are made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. When a collapse of a supernova leaves behind a neutron star, the matter in the neutron star contains only neutrons. So we all know that opposite charges attract and same charges repel, right? So if I have two protons, they don't want to be next to each other. So there's a certain amount of space I can fit them into. If I'm instead considering only neutrons, I can pack them in like this, like sardines. So all neutron matter can be very, very, very dense. In fact, what we're looking at is something like a couple of solar masses, something as big as the sun, squeezed into something the size of Fermilab. Okay, so a couple of miles across. That's what you're looking at in a neutron star. And it's practically invisible because it's so small and so faint. And again, that could be a macho. All right, now on to the really crazy idea of black holes. Now you probably have all heard some things about black holes. Okay, give me a show of hands if you have some idea what about black holes. All right, good, okay. Tell me something about a black hole. Something interesting about black hole. Okay, you can go through it to a different dimension. That's a possibility. We'll never really know for sure, but yeah, the people speculate. Light does not escape. Okay, that's what makes them black, right? So if I take a baseball and I throw it up away from the Earth, it's going to come back down, right? That's because there's some escape velocity of the Earth and its gravity, and I can't throw a baseball faster than the escape velocity, and no one can. Now, a black hole has such strong gravity that the escape velocity is greater than the speed of light. So even light beams never escape the gravitational pull of a black hole. Okay, something else interesting about a black hole. Oh, I know you know more about a black hole than that.
It warps space.
It warps space and time, okay. Now, that's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, but it's a little tricky to understand. So you can think of gravity as not being a force at all. You can either think of it as a force, and that's not really incorrect, but there's a whole other way to think about it, which is also correct, which is that it just simply changes the geometry of space and time in the proximity of the gravity. So when you took high school geometry, you learned rules like the three angles in a triangle add up to 180 degrees, and two parallel lines will never cross one another, right? Well, that's only true in something known as Euclidean space, or sometimes called flat space. In the presence of gravity, space is not Euclidean and space is not flat. It gets warped and curved and distorted. And when that happens, these angles and triangles get bent. Kind of like if you draw a triangle now instead of on a flat surface, you do on, say, a globe. Those angles won't add up to 180. Similarly, lines of longitude on a map, well, they cross at the poles, right? Those are parallel lines that cross. So in the presence of gravity, you see these sorts of things happening. And because of that change in the geometry of space and time, you get gravity. So in the presence of, say, our sun, which creates gravity, it warps space-time a little. In the presence of a black hole, it warps it dramatically. And it makes all of our intuition about space and time kind of obsolete. I'll give you an example. So, for one thing, the way that the time passes is very different depending on your frame of reference. So if I'm in a spacecraft orbiting a black hole, and I'm an unsavory fellow, so I push my friend out the door into the black hole. To his perspective, in his frame of reference, he falls into the black hole screaming all the way into the middle. To my perspective, that will never happen. He will fall and approach a surface around the black hole known as the event horizon, or Schwarzschild radius, but he will never pass it. He will slow down as he approaches it and then eventually fade from view. This is because the rate of time is passing differently for me as an observer outside the black hole than it does to somebody in the black hole. It's just one of the many peculiar features of Einstein's theory of relativity. So you can think of it this way. The distance between me and that event horizon gets stretched in my frame of reference as a result of the gravity. In fact, it gets infinitely stretched, making it impossible to ever cross it because it's an infinite distance as far as my frame of reference is concerned. One thing that means is that I can never possibly get inside the black hole, or I can never see anything inside the black hole, rather, and nothing inside the black hole could ever see me. They're completely disconnected from one another in any causal sense. So people talk about the insides of black holes as being really other dimensions because they're not accessible. We can't look inside it and it can't look out. They're completely disconnected regions of space. Okay? Okay, so back to machos. We have several possibilities. We have black holes, like I said, neutron stars, white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, big planets, all of these things. Well, since you know the early 80s and all the way through the 90s, people looked for these sorts of objects. They look for them through a process called gravitational lensing. So say you have some very bright object like a star or a galaxy, and then you have your telescope here. Normally, you know, light travels from here to here, and it's a certain brightness. But now imagine there's some black hole or other macho, and it's traveling between the two objects. Well, as light goes from here, it will come like this and then get pulled by its gravity inward and focus it to the telescope. It's just like a lens does, but through gravity. So when that alignment happens, that macho makes the distant object seem much brighter just for a little while. So what you do is you take a telescope and look at a field of view in the sky, and you look for new bright objects to appear just for a day or two. You know, that's usually how long they brighten for. And then once you see that happen, you take a much more powerful telescope and focus in there and see if you can actually find the macho. And they did. They found instances of neutron stars and white dwarfs. They even found some black holes. But they didn't find nearly enough to make up the dark matter. Probably 5% or something of the dark matter are machos, maybe less, but not most of it. So machos, WIMPs, yeah, WIMPs won that one. So on to WIMPs. Okay, so first let me give you a survey of the particles we know exist before I explain why we need a different one to make up the dark matter. So the particles that exist that we know about at places like Fermilab and other places have discovered are known as fermions and bosons. These are essentially the two types. The fermions are the kinds of particles we think of as matter, and the bosons are those we think of force carriers, the things that communicate the forces we know about in nature. On the fermion side, we have the electron and two other particles that are a lot like the electron but heavier called a muon and tau. So there's three. We have six different quarks, which are the things that make up protons, neutrons, and other stuff like that. So that's nine. And then we have three particles called neutrinos. I'll get back to neutrinos in a second. On the boson side, we have the photon, which is the reason the electromagnetic force exists. We have the gluon, which explains why quarks get held together in protons and neutrons so well. And we have two particles called the W and Z, which mediate a different force called the weak force. So of all of those particles, we should notice all of them quite well. If there were a lot of them out there, they would be obvious. For example, if the space was filled with clouds of electrons, well, these things give off a lot of light because they're charged, and they would emit radiation, and we'd notice them. So they'd be a really lousy candidate for dark matter. Same thing with muons and taus and quarks. Same thing with these different bosons I mentioned. None of these would be a very good candidate for dark matter. The neutrinos are perhaps the exception. So neutrinos would be good dark matter candidates in principle because they don't interact by the electromagnetic or strong forces, which means they're practically completely disjoint from the world we know. For example, the particle of a neutrino, which is super light and travels about the speed of light, could go straight into the Earth and come out on the other side without ever noticing the Earth was there. It just simply isn't aware of the ordinary matter in our world. It's not always the case that we'll travel without hitting the Earth, but depending on its energy, it might be like one out of a million times it would recoil with something in the Earth. But the other vast majority of the times, it would never know it's there. So you could imagine that our whole galaxy is filled with huge quantities of neutrinos, and this is the dark matter. In fact, people thought that for quite some time. They thought that was their best guess for what this dark matter we were talking about was. So the only problem with that is that we've done very complex and sophisticated computer simulations of what galaxies would look like if they were made up of neutrinos, and they don't look like real galaxies. They look bigger and more extended, and they're not as concentrated. The problem is that neutrinos are so light and fast-moving that they don't congeal enough. The real dark matter is something slow, heavy, and congeals a little better, which we call cold dark matter. So since none of the known forms of matter have these properties, we're forced to try to invent some other new kind of matter that we haven't yet discovered that must constitute the dark matter. So there are two possibilities I'll talk about for what that particle might be. Somebody suggested extra dimensions, was over here, and I'll do that one second. First, I'll talk about an idea called supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is probably my favorite particle physics idea. In fact, I've written the second book, and it's all about supersymmetry. It will come out in September. I encourage you to read it if you're interested. So supersymmetry is an idea that has to do with these two types of matter I mentioned, fermions and bosons, right? So fermions, like I said, are the kinds of particles that make up matter as we normally think of it, and bosons are those kinds of particles that generate force. Supersymmetry says you can't have one without the other. It says for any given fermion, there has to be a particle which is essentially identical to it, but is instead a boson, and vice versa. That means that for every kind of particle we know about in nature, there is a copy of it that we've never discovered, probably because it's too heavy to be produced in our accelerators just yet. So that means for the photon, which is a boson, there's a fermion, which we call the photino. And for the electron, which is a fermion, there's a boson called the selectron. For the neutrinos, there are sneutrinos. For the quarks, there are squarks. For the Z, there's a zeno. The gluon, there's gluinos, etc. Where the dark matter comes in is that some of these bosons would have partners that would be exactly what we want in a dark matter candidate. Things like the photino, the zeno, and particles also known as the Higgsinos, all of these things would be slow, heavy, non-interacting in the traditional sense, and would be produced in the early universe in the kind of abundances we need to make up the dark matter. And that's our single best guess about what that is.
So you're saying all of these things are hypothetical?
Yes, they are theoretical constructs at this time. We have a lot of good reasons to think they would exist from a mathematical perspective. You know, when there are certain problems with physics as we understand them, and these solve several of them simultaneously. So it's our single best guess at this point, but it's only a hypothetical thing. We hope to, in the near future, just find out if we're right about it. But at the moment, we don't know.
Throughout the course of your conversation, you're using the term slow and fast. You're inferencing motion.
Mm-hmm.
All of this stuff is moving. What gives it the impetus to move?
These particles are essentially a gas of particles. And if we focused in on the gas of molecules in this room, you'd find they're all moving, at least relative to one another. You need to talk in a given frame of reference, but it's just saying the frame of reference of this room, all those particles are kind of moving around randomly. Anything with a temperature has motion. And really, just about everything has a temperature. A state of absolute rest is a very peculiar state. If anything disturbs a state of absolute rest, it's then in motion. I should also add that when I talk about things being slow in this context, what I mean is slow relative to the speed of light. I'm still talking about a few hundred miles per second. So that's what I mean by slow. Neutrinos are traveling much, much faster than that.
But I still come back to example of the galaxies and the planets and everything. What you had the Big Bang, okay, and you have these various stars exploding, etc. That I can understand through combustion, etc. And there's force, okay. But what is giving all of this matter motion in various directions all over the cosmos?
What I would say to that is imagine for a second something that isn't moving. Okay, let's just say I went out into the galaxy, say, and I put a particle at rest, say rest relative to the galaxy. Well, it wouldn't be long before it started to fall in from the gravity towards the middle of our galaxy. The state of rest just isn't something that is maintained very, very long in nature. Similarly, if I put a molecule of oxygen or whatever at this moment right here, and I really at rest, and I let it go, it would fall downward. It'd be in motion very quickly. And it wouldn't...
Gravity.
Sure. Gravity is one of the forces that cause things to move.
So why wouldn't the universe just collapse?
There are other forces at play as well. So... The Earth is in a stable orbit around the Sun, despite the gravity pulling it in, but it has, like I said, centrifugal force pulling it out in those kind of balance. Similarly, in the atmosphere, this other example, an oxygen molecule, gravity pulls it down, but eventually it hits another atom or molecule in the room and bounces, and then they bounce another, and they're kind of just in perpetual billiard ball mode as they travel through the room. So there are lots of forces at play, all of which can affect a particle's motion. In this absolute state of rest is actually very hard to achieve. Well, tachyons are okay. All particles one could possibly imagine are one of three things. One is radiation, which means it travels uniquely at the speed of light. Light is such a thing. Gluons are such a thing. These things travel at exactly the speed of light, never more, never less, at least in empty space. Then there are the other kinds of particles we know about, which always travel less than the speed of light. Okay, no matter how much energy I give to an electron, it can never, ever, ever pass the speed of light. It can approach it, but it can never pass it. That's why at Fermilab, where we're accelerating protons and antiprotons together, we give them a ton of energy, but it will never exceed the speed of light. It goes to 99.9999% of the speed of light, but never more than the speed of light. Tachyons are the third possibility, which are particles that can only go faster than the speed of light. We've never known such a particle to exist, but they're mathematically possible to write down. There's one real problem, though, with the possibility that they would exist. If you take Einstein's theory of relativity, it says that if in some frame of reference you have a tachyon, something going faster than the speed of light, then there's another frame of reference you could instead study the problem from. So from somebody else's perspective, that particle would be traveling backwards in time. Well, that might seem okay with you, but it leads to all sorts of paradoxes. You know, if you watch science fiction movies, you know this. You have the problem that I could use this tachyon-based technology to send particles backwards in time, to communicate a message to somebody to make sure that they kill my grandfather before he meets my grandmother. And then I wouldn't exist and I wouldn't send the message, and then, you know, you see the problem, right? The standard grandfather paradox. So my guess is that the reason that doesn't happen is because tachyons don't exist. But I don't know. The universe is strange, so I'm not gonna guarantee that. Okay, so I promised you a second possibility for what the WIMPs are, having to do with extra dimensions of space. So this is one of my favorite ideas. I'm not going to say that I think it's particularly likely to be true, but it could be. And people, real physicists, and myself and many others, have written lots of papers about these sorts of things. And we think it's worth looking for anyway. The idea is this. There are certain theories, including string theory, which we find very appealing as mathematical physicists for lots of reasons. I'm not really going to get into them now. But some of these theories, including string theory, suggest that there aren't three dimensions of space and one of time, but a total of something like 10 or 11 space and time dimensions. And you might ask the question of, well, why don't we see them? You know, why do we experience three dimensions of space if there are really 9 or 10? Well, one possibility is that they're wrapped up in very small kind of loops that we don't notice. So to help you understand that, picture this. So imagine instead of an infinite universe that goes on in forever in all directions, imagine a universe that if I went far enough that way, eventually I would come out over there. So some of you might know the old arcade game Asteroids. Who's ever played Asteroids? All right. So what happens when you fly off the screen in Asteroids? You come back on the other side. Okay, it's the way that the Atari company or whatever dealt with the finite size of their screen. So imagine that the real world was that way, and it might be. It might be. It just is probably so big that we wouldn't notice it. But it's possible that eventually the space wraps around like that. So, if you had a fourth dimension of space, but now you made the size of that dimension, so the amount of space you have to traverse before you go around that, you know, come out the other side, if you made that very, very small, so small that the only thing that could ever travel in it was very, very small. And in other words, it would take a huge amount of energy for a given particle to fit in that dimension. If that were the case, then it would be as if that dimension weren't there. We would never notice it, unless you have a particle with enough energy to access it. So I think that was probably confusing. So I'm going to try to say it again in a slightly better way. Sometimes I know when I'm being confusing, sometimes I don't. I'm right, that was confusing, right? Okay. Okay. So if you take an individual particle, you can think of it as a wave. Okay, quantum physics says that particles are waves and waves are particles. Now imagine you have a bathtub and you fill it with water, and there are certain patterns of waves you can fit in that bathtub. You know, ones that will kind of be stable for a while. You know, if this is the size of the bathtub, it could look like this, or like this, or even like this, right? But there's a certain size that will fit, right? I can't fit a wave 10 bathtub lengths in my bathtub, right? So now that bathtub is my extra dimension. As I make that bathtub smaller and smaller and smaller, I need smaller and smaller waves to fit in it, okay? In order to propagate in that extra dimension, you have to have a smaller and smaller wavelength. Well, in order for a particle to have a small wavelength, it needs to have a big energy. Big energy means small wavelength. So now imagine that bathtub extra dimension is so tiny that in order for a particle to wave in that direction, it has to be ridiculously energetic, more energetic than the particles we accelerate at Fermilab. Okay? Then we would never know. They could all be there. There could be tons of wrapped up little tiny dimensions like this that we're not noticing. But now imagine that back when the universe was young and hot, there were lots of particles that were moving that fast. And some of them started waving in that dimension, and they just kept waving in that dimension. And then the universe cooled, and those particles are still moving in that dimension, but we don't see it because we're not made of particles moving that fast. So I ask you this, what would a particle moving in an extra dimension look like to us? Well, you probably don't have the tools to figure that out, but I'll give you a hint, all right? Einstein said that energy and mass were essentially the same thing. Okay, equals mc squared. So, well, I should be more precise. Mass is one kind of energy. Motion is another kind of energy. Okay? So energy really equals a part that has to do with mass plus a part that has to do with motion. So now I return to this question. A particle moving in an extra dimension of space would appear to us like a heavy particle. We don't see it moving, but it has all this energy from motion that we can't perceive, but we still notice its gravity and we still notice its energy. That's mass. So if you had otherwise ordinary particles, like say an electron or a photon or whatever, moving in an extra dimension of space, it would appear to us to be like a very, very heavy electron or a very, very heavy photon. We call these things Kaluza-Klein states. We don't know that they exist because we don't know extra dimensions exist. But if extra dimensions exist, then they should exist. And you could imagine otherwise ordinary particles like photons traveling in extra dimensions being the dark matter of our universe. Those could fill the whole galaxy and other galaxies and provide all that heavy mass that is missing from ordinary matter could come in the form of this motion in extra dimensional space. Pretty wild, huh?
But if it's in an extra dimension, how would it interact with this dimension?
Well, okay, so, you know, all the atoms in my body aren't just in one dimension, right? They're in these three, you know, plus time. So this would be something that's in all of those dimensions and moving in one other. So, everything really is in all dimensions, okay? In the sense of the word I'm using, dimension. But ordinary matter only ordinary matter in the sense of the stuff in my body is only moving through the three, right? It doesn't, it's not energetic enough to fit in the small dimensions. But if something did have enough energy, then instead of moving in only the three, it would move in four or five or six or whatever it is. So you can't take something out of these three dimensions. You can only make others accessible to it.
That explains 3 + 1. You were referring to 10 or 11 dimensions.
You could imagine them all being small like this. You could imagine other things, too. So we really don't know what they're all like. But all in total, string theory tells us, at least the current version of string theory tells us, there should be 10 or 11 or something. And they could be wrapped up in a lot of complicated different ways. We're really only speculating when we go that far. We're really speculating when we talk about extra dimensions at all. But especially speculating when we tell you too many specific things about them.
Do you have any proposed ideas for why nature would exist in this way with these multiple dimensions?
So the question was, do we have any ideas of why nature would exist in this particular arrangement with 10 dimensions or whatever? When it comes to questions of why about the universe, that's kind of a difficult question to ask a scientist. We tend to ask questions of how or what, why is something we are, you know, shy away from sometimes. But there are questions of mathematical consistency that we address. And the reason string theorists talk about 10 dimensions and not our ordinary 3, or 3 plus time, is because they've found that you can't solve certain mathematical problems in 3 plus time. In fact, you run into these problems of various calculations diverging off to infinity, they say, and where you can't make sensible answers out of your theory unless you do it in 10 or 11 dimensions. So there's a certain degree of mathematical self-consistency or just having a theory that makes sense. And sometimes that forces you to a conclusion like this. There are other cases of that. We have a theory, a very, very good theory called quantum field theory or quantum electrodynamics, which explains how electric charge and photons interact. And it's one of our most successful theories ever contemplated by humankind. And you write down the theory, and it doesn't really give you any freedom. It says if you change the theory even slightly in various ways, and immediately the answers it produces go off to infinity, like I said, and don't produce sensible results. The only way you can structure the theory that leads to sensible results, for example, is for the photon particle to have zero mass. If it had a tiny, tiny, tiny mass that's not zero, the theory would break. It wouldn't work. So mathematical self-consistency forces us to conclude that the photon is exactly massless. String theorists are forced to conclude, they say, that the universe must be 10 or 11 dimensional. It just simply, by pure logic, they say, couldn't have been any other way. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the closest I can do in a why question. Yeah, that's hard. What an extra dimension of time is like. So I'm going to try, but it might not be satisfactory because I'm not sure I can really picture it well myself. So if one dimension is like a line, okay, and we're at different places along the line, imagine now a plane. And imagine if this is the plane, I can only, instead of having... Well, and time only goes one way. So here you can go this way and this way or any combination thereof, right? So now you might have different trajectories through two-dimensional time, but there would be a broader series of events taking place. So at any given point in space, there would be a plethora of different events that simultaneously took place, or simultaneously isn't really the right word, but on top of one another took place in different points in this time plane. it's not clear that that doesn't lead to paradoxes. It probably does. And we normally talk about one dimension of time, although occasionally people speculate about more.
Do we have a definition of time?
Within Einstein's theory, time is pretty well defined. But I don't know that I have a definition I can put in the words that would tell you anything you don't already know. You have a pretty good idea of what time is already. Normally, physicists talk about time as two events happen at the same time. I'm going to have to think about that better. I used to have a pretty precise definition in my head. I don't think I do offhand anymore, though. But it's what you think time is. I mean, your definition of time is not very different in any real sense than how a physicist used the word.
About a month ago, I read something that they had what they thought was the first photographs of dark matter around a galaxy that had to do with, I think, some refraction around X-rays. I could never quite understand the explanation.
Okay.
Well,
I think the image you've seen, and I'm not completely sure that I'm talking about the same thing you're describing, but I think I am, is this particular pair of clusters of galaxies that pass through one another 100 billion years ago, or 100 million years ago or so. But the image, the part of it that looks like dark matter is actually inferred by the gravitational lensing, that same thing I talked about before that focused it. So you can use telescopes to detect where the gravity is and use that to kind of construct a map of where the dark matter is. I think that's what you probably read about, although I can't be sure. So I've spent 3/4 of my time talking about dark matter, and I haven't even mentioned dark energy in any detail. So let me change gears and try to say a few things about that first. So I said at the beginning of the talk that 4 or 5% is ordinary matter of our universe. About 20-25% is dark matter, and the rest, the majority, is dark energy. Dark energy is very peculiar, but to explain it, I need to go back to Einstein. So Einstein's greatest achievement among many, but his single greatest, is his general theory of relativity. It explains how force is manifest through the geometry and curvature of space-time, and how these things are related, intimately connected to one another. So when he published his theory back in 1915, within a few years of that, people started, including himself, started looking at his equations and saying, well, we can apply this to the universe as a whole. We don't just have to apply it to things like stars and planets and baseballs and other sorts of common things. We can do it to the whole universe. And when he did, he found something very disturbing. He found that his theory predicted that space itself should expand or contract with time. In other words, if you have two objects and they're not connected to one another, if you let time pass, they should get closer or farther apart from one another, everywhere, throughout all space. Well, Einstein didn't like this idea. He thought that was fairly absurd. His universe, as he experienced it, seemed to be pretty static and unchanging. So he sought out a way to try to make his equation say it's going to be static and unchanging. So he added a new term into his equation. In addition to the stuff that was already there that had to be there, he said, well, there's one other mathematical possibility, which is this sort of thing exists. And when he wrote that in, he fixed it to just the right size so it would stabilize things. It would keep things frozen in place. And that was a state of affairs for quite some time. And then in 1929, I think, or right around then, Edwin Hubble, the guy who the Hubble Space Telescope has been named after, observed for the first time that the universe is expanding. He looked deeper into space with more powerful telescopes than had been done by many people at that time. And he saw the farther away you look back, the faster away these galaxies were moving from us. So you don't notice it in short distances, because if this space is growing, it's not growing very much. It's growing very slow. If instead we look at something that's, you know, millions of light years in size, well, then you start to notice that things are moving you know, kilometers per second or tens or hundreds of kilometers per second away from you. And the farther the thing is away from us, the faster it's moving. So Einstein took this in and concluded, you know what, I was wrong to add this term. I was just philosophically blinded by my own prejudice about how the universe must be. I'm going to throw it out. He called it the biggest blunder of his life, that term. Well, since then, that kind of picture was the standard cosmology among physicists and cosmologists and astronomers for many decades. And we got to a point in the 1990s when we had measured a lot of the properties of our universe and learned a lot about how Einstein's theory played into it. And we're trying to measure, how much matter and energy was in the universe, and use that to infer what Einstein's equation said specifically about it. In particular, the history and evolution of our universe depends on how much matter and energy is present in it. Since our universe is expanding now, we could use the equations to kind of run them backwards, and we saw that the universe gets smaller and smaller and smaller. The temperature gets higher and higher and higher because there's the same amount of stuff in less volume. And it goes back to a point where the universe was infinitely small, infinitely hot, and we call that the Big Bang. And at that moment, space and time simultaneously came into existence. But that didn't tell us what would happen in the future. It turns out, according to Einstein's equations, that there was a lot of matter and energy in the universe, a sufficient amount. Then eventually the universe will expand and come to a halt and then contract again and kind of do a Big Bang in reverse. It's called a Big Crunch. If there were much less matter and energy in the universe, then it will never come to a halt and it will just keep getting bigger forever. And the third possibility is that you're right in the line. It's a critical density universe where it's not enough to make it fall back in on itself, but it kind of plateaus. It reaches a maximum size and then kind of just stops. And it just stays that size, approaches this plateau. And those three possibilities also had to do with the geometry of space and time itself. That middle possibility, the last one I said, is called a flat universe. And in such a universe, these Euclidean laws you learned about in high school geometry apply as long as you're not next to a star or planet or something. And in the absence of gravity, you know, parallel lines stay parallel, and triangles' angles add up to 180 degrees, etc. And the kind of universe that ends in a big crunch, a closed universe, you find that these angles add up to not 180, and the lines actually converge like the lines of longitude do on a globe. In an open universe, it's opposite. The parallel lines depart from one another. If you follow them long enough, the angles of the triangle again don't add up to 180. Very strange stuff. And in the 90s, we were going to measure this well enough to know which one we live in. Well, they found out that none of them were right. The universe expansion rate is getting bigger and bigger, and the rate at which it's getting bigger is getting bigger. It's accelerating. None of those three possibilities suggested that could be what we would find. But there is one way to make Einstein's equations allow for the possibility of a universe that's accelerating its expansion, and that's to include that stupid term that Einstein originally wrote in to fudge things. You have to put a different value for it in. You have to change it from a plus sign to a minus sign. But if you do those things, this cosmological term that Einstein had once introduced causes this sort of accelerated expansion. So you ask, what does this term mean? Like, mathematics and physics is only good if it means something, right? And it always does. It's just sometimes hard to interpret. But what it actually means is it's the energy present in empty space. So if I take this cube of space, this meter by meter by meter, say, and I take every particle there is in it out. I make it a perfect vacuum. Well, this term in Einstein's equations that he put in denotes how much energy is still in it. And it's a kind of energy that's different from other kinds. For one, you can't dilute it. If the universe expands, and I take a cubic centimeter and I stretch it into a cubic meter, as happens over time, I will get more and more and more energy density. or not more density, the same energy density, but more energy. Because if the density stays fixed and you increase the volume, you also increase the energy. So you're actually creating energy as you expand. So we call this energy, this vacuum energy that's stuck in space itself, we call it dark energy. In the presence of that energy, which is something like 3/4 of all the energy in our universe, that is what causes the accelerated rate of expansion. At least that's what, as we understand it now, that's the case. We don't understand these things very well. Dark matter we understand pretty well. We've measured it in lots of ways. We have some pretty good ideas of what it is and why it's there. Dark energy is a much harder nut to crack. We are just barely beginning to figure out some things about it. Okay, so we've got about 5 minutes. Let's use those 5 minutes to do some questions and things.
Can scientists envisage what went on before the Big Bang?
Well, so before the Big Bang is a phrase that is in itself paradoxical, because if time, just like space, came into existence at the Big Bang, well, how can you talk about something, an event that happened without time? So as we understand it, I mean, and we don't, in the tiny fraction of an instant following a Big Bang is still a mystery to us, but as we understand it, there is no such thing as before the Big Bang. It'd be like talking about a location outside of space or the longitude and latitude of a point not on the Earth's surface. You know, it's just something you can't put words to.
When you reference dark energy, how are you defining energy?
Say again?
What is your definition of energy?
Energy, as physicists use it, is really just anything that gravity acts upon. So gravity pulls on matter and energy, on mass and energy.
So the pulling, the action of pulling, is what energy is?
What's the difference between matter and energy in this case? Okay. Well, it's not matter for a few reasons. One, it comes down to this lack of dilution. If I put a certain amount of mass in a volume and I stretch that volume out, I don't gain more mass by doing that. I lower the density. It gets diluted as I do that, right? Okay. Dark energy, you can't dilute. It's present in the space itself, and there's nothing you can do to get rid of it or reduce it. If you triple the volume, you triple the energy. I spend a lot of time trying to conceive of it, so I don't think it's impossible, but it's certainly very counterintuitive. Our minds as we know them aren't very equipped to think about some of these things. You have to really trick them into understanding some stuff.
Okay, but as you're expressing it with dark matter, it does have a sense of an element of beingness, and of existence.
Sure, both exist, yes.
And also, it creates gravity.
Mm-hmm, both create gravity in slightly different ways, but yes.
Does dark matter move?
Yes. Dark matter is a gas of particles. The particles travel through space just like any other gas of particles would. Dark energy, I don't know even how to talk about it moving. It's something, it's a property of space. And if I knew more about it, I might be able to tell you if dark energy moved. But neither I nor anyone else in the world understands dark energy at that level yet.
Okay, so it could be that dark energy doesn't move, it just happens to be space as an energy.
That's a perfectly adequate description given how little we know about it right now, yeah.
You said that dark energy is in effect continuously created. How does that fit in with conservation of energy?
It doesn't. The law of conservation of energy is still very applicable and works in virtually every situation, but it you shouldn't apply it to the case of dark energy. It doesn't work.
So, given that there's so little understanding of dark energy, what's the approach to gain greater understanding?
Good question. So for one thing, we hope to measure, for example, the rate of the universe's expansion in more detail to try to learn more about how dark energy acts on it. There are other possibilities too, like understanding a phase of the universe's early history we call inflation, which may or may not have something to do with arc energy. People think it might, things like this. But, you know, it's an empirical science, and, well, all science is empirical, and we're trying to measure as much as we can to have more to go on. But right now, I'm a theoretical physicist, and I would like to work on dark energy, except we don't have enough in the way of observations to really guide us and give us something to work with. Right now, we're in the dark. Again, excuse the pun. I hate puns, so I mean, I really, really hate it. With dark matter, we have much more clear paths to learning more about it. For one thing, at places like the Tevatron, which is the big accelerator at Fermilab, we're hoping to actually create particles of dark matter. So when you accelerate particles to near the speed of light and smash them together, you're essentially putting a great deal of energy at one place at one time. And Einstein's equals mc squared says that if you get enough energy in one place at one time, you can make things with a lot of mass, including, hopefully, dark matter particles. We haven't done that yet, but we would like to, and we're working at that. If we can't do it at the Tevatron, the chances are we'll be able to do it at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, which will go online later this year. So we're eagerly awaiting that. Okay. Without knowing what it is, I have a really hard time speculating about if it could be destroyed. I can't imagine a way you could destroy it, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be done. Right now, we don't know enough to even answer that. You had a question before.
I do have an empirical question. My brother, who couldn't be here, wants to know. Maybe we just don't have the right equipment or technology yet. Yeah, the Hadron, the Large Hadron Accelerator will be collided.
Mm-hmm.
Will hopefully answer some questions. But what about at the other end, going with the telescopes?
So. Absolutely. It's a funny how this comes. It's funny how this goes full circle. So these are questions that we are simultaneously trying to look at the smallest structure of our universe in these particle accelerators to find out the tiny tiniest little parts inside of atoms. We're trying to understand it at that end, and at the same time, we point our telescopes up in space to try to see the biggest scales of our universe at the same time to answer the same questions, or hopefully get enough information from each to put together to give us an answer. So, for example, we have a telescope that's being constructed. Well, I don't actually know if it's being constructed, but the parts are being devised and programs are being written to work at, called SNAP, Supernova. I don't know what it stands for. SNAP. It's a satellite-based telescope that will study the expansion history of the world, of the universe, with much greater precision than any telescope's ever been able to measure. So they're going to look back to many billions of years ago and see how the universe was expanding then. And you might think it's strange that we can look back in time, but that's what looking far away is, right? Because the light from the thing we're looking at took billions of years to get to us. So by looking billions of light years away, you're really looking billions of years in the past. And that's just one of many possibilities. There's another satellite that is supposed to go up later this year, a telescope called GLAST, Gamma Ray Large Area Satellite Telescope, probably. GLAST is a gamma ray telescope, and among other things, it's going to look for particles that are created in dark matter annihilation. So when two dark matter particles get near each other, there's a small chance that they'll destroy each other and produce other things, including gamma rays. So they're looking for gamma rays from that process. So I could go on and on and on. There are lots of experiments in lots of different ways, including telescopes and particle accelerators and other things I didn't have time to talk about, all of which hopefully will give us some new insight into these questions.
Is there any work being done on approaching it from a different way of thinking? In other words, more intuitive thinking instead of deductive thinking?
Well,
most of this, my understanding of Einstein really came to the theory of relativity, really not from a deductive standpoint. It was really more of an intuitive insight, and then he could go backwards and induce his conclusions afterward. And I'm wondering about, it seems like we're always hedging up on the nature of the limits of logic and discursive thought, and that we need to kind of find ways to jump into a different, as somebody proposed before, states of awareness or consciousness or alternate realities, because we do know those exist. But again, the scientific community doesn't seem to be very well versed in those approaches.
Well,
since society is really based on a lot of those kinds of approaches, alternative ways of experiencing reality based on different theoretical frameworks.
Well, so especially among theoretical physicists, you know, the one of the most important personality traits for people who are going to do theoretical physics work is the ability to think in ways that maybe other people aren't thinking in. I mean, Einstein is a great historical example, right? I mean, he had all these weird personality traits and things. He wasn't like most people. And I'm not just saying he was smart or something. It's different than that. He was a different kind of person in a lot of respects. I don't think I agree with your assertion, though, that he or other successful scientists gave up logic in that part of thinking, though. Einstein was extremely logical. He used logic at kind of with a depth that most people simply can't contemplate, to be honest. And he thought logically about, well, you know, what would it really mean to be traveling on a light beam next to another light beam? And he found logical paradoxes, and he explored those paradoxes in hope of finding a resolution to the paradoxes, and eventually he did. And fortunately, there are lots of theoretical physicists today who have a wide variety of strange personality quirks and characteristics that, and many of them do think in very different ways. I like to think that sometimes I think in different ways, but I'm probably not at the level of some of these guys. I think unconventional thinking is essential in this line of work, and we need all types to kind of put their heads together. You don't know what solution or what approach is going to lead the solution eventually, but it definitely requires thinking outside of the conventional box. So maybe one or two more before we go over to the bookstore. Is that right? Okay.
It seems like recently I was reading something about string theory postulating the existence of the universe and it changing because of these other dimensions, but somehow that appears in another dimension and then collapses or whatever. Is it, I'm not sure where to take that.
So the question was about, he had read about how the universe's properties could change within the context of string theory and how some of the extra dimensions could maybe, you know, have been large at one point and wrapped up and other sorts of things like this. These are all perfectly reasonable possibilities given the context of this theory, but it really is just kind of speculating. But there are lots of hypotheses about how a universe like ours could have emerged from some sort of multidimensional framework, and how string theory could predict all sorts of different, allow all sorts of possible ways for that to happen. There's the other possibility that is string theorists like and others like, which is that there isn't just one universe as we think of it, but that through a process, the process known as inflation, for example, different pieces of space kind of cool off and take form as a universe at different stages of inflation. And when those do, they each have slightly different sorts of dynamical conditions, they're slightly different than each other. And when they emerge, those dimensions of space wrap up in different ways and create universes with different properties. So you can imagine, you know, huge, vast numbers, maybe an infinite number of different universes, if you want to call them that, that have, say, different forces in them and different kinds of matter and different kinds of laws of nature. People call this the landscape of universes. And these sorts of things are being talked about very seriously for the first time in recent years. One more question, and we'll go over to Quest.
With the universe continuing to expand, is there any theory as to what it's expanding into?
So this is kind of the kind of question that I think leads to a paradox in and of itself, in much the way as asking before the Big Bang sorts of phrases. Like, space can't expand into something because you'd call that something space, and then nothing would be happening, right? So we're not talking about expanding into anything. It's getting bigger without anything else getting smaller. One way that I like to think about it that helps me wrestle with that a little more effectively is say, okay, well, instead of thinking of space getting bigger, I can think of all the stuff in the space getting smaller. And it's really the same thing. So imagine I have my asteroids game, okay? I'm playing asteroids again. And imagine my TV were to grow, but all the icons on the screen, all the objects on the screen stay the same size. Well, that's an expanding universe as we normally think of it. Alternatively, the TV could stay fixed, and all of the asteroids and the ship and everything could just shrink. There's no difference. They're exactly equivalent ways of thinking about the same set of observations. You could never distinguish those two scenarios. So if you have a really hard time imagining space getting bigger without it getting into something, just think of all the stuff, including like the constants like the speed of light, getting smaller with time. It's the same thing.